22510, Randy Lee Camwell versus the State of Nevada. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Petty?
I am, Your Honor. Good morning, Justice Hardesty, Justice Douglas, Justice Pickering. My name is John Petty. I'm Chief Deputy with the Washoe County Public Defender's Office, and I'm here today on behalf of Appellant Randy Lee Camwell. Good morning, Mr. Hardesty. At the outset, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. And I know that this is a before the court as a fast-track appeal, and normally there aren't reply briefs filed in fast-track appeals, so one wasn't filed in this case, but I'd like to reserve 3 minutes if I may.
Okay.
This appeal presents, I think, three interesting issues. The first issue concerns the interference by the prosecutor with a member of the defense team in terms of contacting an eyewitness. The second issue involves prosecutorial misconduct during closing argument with some improper comments made by the prosecutor. And the third issue dealing with the kidnapping conviction itself. And with the court's permission, I'd like to address the last issue and then work my way through the other issues as time permits. Unless, of course, this court has a particular issue that they want to have addressed immediately, which I'd like to...
The second would be a preferred approach.
The prosecutorial misconduct? All right. In this particular case, the jury had been instructed, and the prosecutor got up to begin her closing arguments. And right out of the chute, in fact, she begins her closing arguments at page 60 of the transcript of volume 8, I believe. And by page 63, this is what she has to say. So putting all these ideas together, you know that this defendant no longer bears the presumption of innocence. The trial is closed, and he sits here right now. He is a guilty man on all counts, end quote. Now, that is classic Morales error. And when I say Morales, I'm referring, of course, to this court's decision in Morales v. State, which is 122 Nevada, 966, 2006 is the year of the decision. And in the brief that was submitted by the state, Mr. Hattelstadt essentially concedes that, in fact, this error occurred. Because Morales says that it is error to say there is no presumption of innocence anymore, and that's essentially what the prosecutor below said in this instance. Now, the record reflects that no objection was made by defense counsel, so as in Morales, this court has to determine whether or not this comment constitutes plain error, and I suggest that the court found a similar comment to be plain error in Morales, and the analysis is identical. So we start with that first piece of misconduct, and then we roll into the second. The second arises out of the situation where during closing argument, during the defense counsel's closing argument, counsel is explaining various aspects of the case and various decisions being made. And at one point, he says to the jury, something to the effect of, now I know you may be asking me, why isn't the defendant testifying? So he's addressing the issue that his client didn't testify. And he goes on to say that in our system of justice, the defendant has the right not to testify, and that it's a constitutional right, and that it is a right that's exercised upon the advice of counsel. And he says that he and his co-counsel told his client, gave him that advice, don't testify. That generated an objection from the prosecutor, Ms. Gloria, and for the life of me, I do not know why, because that is, in fact, a proper explanation to the jury why a defendant might not testify. It's not only proper, as illustrated by the fact that later when the district court gave a specific jury instruction on the issue of the election not to testify, that jury instruction actually said, in part, excuse me, the decision as to, pardon me, the decision as to whether he or she should testify is left to the defendant, acting with the advice and assistance of his or her attorney. And that is found in volume one of the joint appendix at page 40. That is the instruction that the judge gave to the jury in this case. And it essentially mirrors exactly what Mr. Davies told the jury. So there wasn't anything improper about that. Nonetheless, the court sustained the objection, and Mr. Davies went on to say...
Well, he did go further than that.
Well, I'll get to the next part, which I also don't find to be in error, and I'll explain. After apologizing to the judge, he then said something to the effect of, this prosecutor is a very talented prosecutor, and that it would be a daunting task to face her in cross-examination. When he said that, he was giving context as to the advice to his client why he should not testify. And that is not improper. And it's not improper because if you look at Griffin v. California, which is a seminal case in this area, if you go back and look at that case, a 1965 case, Justice Douglas, who was writing for the court in the lead opinion, the opinion for the court, quoting from an earlier case of the court, a case called Wilson, noted the following. And I'm not going to give the entire quote, but I thought this little portion was salient to the issue this morning. Justice Douglas, quoting from Wilson, said, quote, "It is not everyone who can safely venture on the witness stand, though entirely innocent of the charge against him. Excessive timidity, nervousness when facing others and attempting to explain transactions of a suspicious character and offenses charged against him will often confuse and embarrass him to such a degree as to increase rather than remove the prejudice against him. It is not everyone, however, honest, who would therefore willingly be placed on the witness stand." Unquote. So the Supreme Court recognized that there are reasons wholly apart from truth or falsity that might give cause to instruct a defendant that it might not be appropriate, given the nature of the offense or the defense, to testify. And all that Mr. Davis was doing was giving context to that. So when he said, and I think it was a compliment, when he says this is a talented attorney, it would be a daunting task to face her in cross-examination, there was nothing improper about that, and I think it finds support in Griffin, as I said, the similar case in this area.
Counsel, isn't it problematic, though, with the little sleight of hand where he inserts, and being an innocent person, and then he goes on, any innocent person, it would still be a daunting task? He slips that in, which takes it kind of to the edge, opposed to just the first part of saying he has a right not to testify, and that's his right, but he slips in, and being an innocent person.
Well, I don't think that it takes it to the edge of anything. I think it's an appropriate comment. He is presumed to be innocent.
I understand. He didn't say presumed. He said an innocent person.
Well, maybe his language was slightly inartful, but I think he was embracing the notion of the presumption of innocence. And so I don't think that he took it close to any improper edge. But I do think this. Having said that, the prosecutor then responded. Of course, she characterizes it as invited error, and we take dispute with that characterization. But she takes it upon herself to respond by noting at some point that the trial is a search for the truth. In fact, she uses the phrase, it is a truth-seeking mission, and then goes on to say this, quote, and when this defense attorney tells you that I'm a big old bad prosecutor with talent, and he's afraid of me and putting his guy on the stand, let me tell you a little history briefly. Cross-examination is an amazing tool that's in our criminal justice system that gets to the truth. So if he doesn't want to put his guy on the stand, why is he afraid of the truth? Now, when you read that, maybe that seems kind of innocuous, but I practice in the Second Judicial District Court, and I know this prosecutor. So when I read it, in my mind, I can hear her voice. So when I read this, I hear something more along the lines of, so if he doesn't want to put his guy on the stand, why? Is he afraid of the truth? That's what I hear when I read it. And that is a comment on the defendant's election not to testify. Now, Ms. Valoria went on to say, I think because she realized that she may have come close to the edge, if not jumped right over the edge, decided that she better clean this record up. And so she then says, well, I was making that reference was only to defense counsel. It has nothing to do with the defendant. I was talking about defense counsel. In Harkness, this court said direct comments on a defendant's inability or election not to testify is a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Whether an indirect comment, if we want to treat it as such, I think it was a direct comment, but if the court wants to treat it as an indirect comment, the test then is whether or not the jury would naturally and necessarily take it to be a comment on the accused's failure to testify. When you put it in the context of her argument that this is a truth-seeking mission, that cross-examination is the greatest single end device to uncover truth, and what is he afraid of, the truth? That clearly is an indirect comment on why his defendant is not testifying in that particular case. And I think that that is error. And it's not just harmless error, although that is the analysis that this court can engage in.
It is grievous. I'd like to go to that point, Mr. Petty. Assuming both comments amount to misconduct, what has troubled me is, and assuming that the second is constitutional, of a constitutional dimension, what I struggle with in this case is the extent to which the misconduct would result in a different jury verdict, whereas here the jury acquitted on attempted murder.
You know, that, and I can see the problem, because intuitively we think to ourselves, well, the jury must not have been too upset by these comments, because they actually found him not guilty of one count, found him guilty of two other counts, and in fact wipes the slate clean as to any of the weapon enhancements. So you say to yourself, well, they must have done what they needed to do.
No, that's not how I would phrase it. They must have done what they needed to do is not, that's a result. I'm asking instead, how is there prejudice where you see an acquittal on the most serious of the offenses? The test isn't they must have done what they needed to do. The test instead is, would the jury verdict on the counts in which there was a conviction have been different but for these misconduct arguments?
And, you know, and I'm not certain that I can answer that question, and I can appreciate the concern that the court has.
Well, can you offer some guidance or some thought process as to what the court or the justices could be considering in the context of a case like this where harmless error is a big issue?
Well, I think that since they found him not guilty of the attempted murder, we can take that charge off the table and look at the charges that they did find him guilty of, which is the most significant one being, of course, the kidnapping charge. And in that particular instance, the kidnapping charge rested on the issue that they had kidnapped her with the intent to either kill her or cause substantial bodily harm. There was no testimony from Mr. Gamwell, so the only evidence that they could consider was the evidence from the state's witnesses. I'm trying to frame this in a sense of that kidnapping count. And as we noted in our brief, the attempted murder charge was dismissed, but they found kidnapping, which meant they had to have considered the substantial bodily injury allegation, of which they were not instructed. I just have to think that this is such error. The prosecutor's comment is such error that I'm just going to suggest that you simply should not rule it out under a harmless error analysis. I believe I want to save my remaining time, but I do want to just comment on the kidnapping charge, because the issue there was they charged kidnapping under a theory of attempt to kill or killing or substantial bodily injury. The jury was completely instructed on attempted murder and murder elements. The jury found him not guilty of attempted murder, did find him guilty of kidnapping, so it must have rested on substantial bodily harm. But the jury was not given a definition on substantial bodily harm. And in Nevada law, substantial bodily harm has a very specific meaning. It's found in NRS 0.060. And it says that substantial bodily harm is that injury that creates a substantial risk of death or which causes serious permanent disfigurement or protracted loss and impairment of a function of a body or prolonged pain. And the evidence simply doesn't support any of the elements of that statute. Unfortunately, the jury didn't have that standard to measure the evidence against. So the evidence that they had, that Ms. Blansett had been beaten, was clearly there, that she had suffered some injuries. The testimony was that when she was seen by the ER doctor, and this is in volume 5 of the volume, Dr. Barnes, he saw that she had some bruises and some abrasions. An officer, Detective Bowen, who saw her later that evening in the emergency room, testified that she had some bruises and abrasions and some swelling. But none of that testimony rose to the level of substantial risk of death or a permanent disfigurement or a protracted loss or impairment of the function of a body, of the body, member, or organ, and not prolonged physical pain as defined by this court in Collins, which is pain that must be in excess of the ordinary pain that would be attendant to, the, in this case, the crime of domestic battery. So because the jury didn't have a standard upon which to measure that evidence, the kidnapping charge, the verdict on the kidnapping charge is suspect. So if you have a weak charge there, and then perhaps this is where how I can tie it all together just as hard as to. If you have a very weak tie there, the evidence doesn't support substantial bodily injury, the jury is not instructed on what that means, and it has a very specific meaning in Nevada law, and then you couple that with the fact that this prosecutor said, what is he afraid of the truth? Maybe that's why we get beyond harmless error on that first issue.
That wouldn't provide a basis for reversal on the burglary, however.
I'm sorry?
That would not provide a basis for a reversal of the burglary.
It may have, no, a burglary, no. The burglary charge I haven't addressed, that would be part and parcel of my argument on the interference with
separation.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Petty. Mr. Hattestad?
Morning, Justice Hardesty, Justice Douglas, and Justice Pickering. Mr. Petty, may it please the court. My name is Gary Hattestad. I'm with the Washoe County DA's office. I represent the respondent in this case. Since we spent most of the time this morning on prosecutorial misconduct, all right if I start there?
Please.
As I wrote up in the fast-track response, I'm not going to contest whether or not the comments by the prosecutor were appropriate. Under the case law, they're inappropriate. The only question is, what's the remedy? And in this case, at least insofar as the presumption of innocence comment is concerned, you know, the Morales case is directly on point. There's no getting around that. It's directly on point, and the comment was clearly incorrect. But there are a few things to take into consideration here in terms of whether or not the comment was mitigated by other events and circumstances during the trial that kept the trial a fair trial. As it was pointed out already, there wasn't any objection to this comment. The verdicts, as you pointed out, Justice Hardesty, seemed to indicate that this comment had no effect whatsoever on the jury's ability to assess the evidence, weigh the evidence, the credibility of the key witness, which was the victim in this case. And as was pointed out, not guilty of attempted murder, and both weapon enhancements were thrown out. So they did not find any of those guilty, even though the prosecutor said that he stood guilty as he sat in the courtroom. The other thing I would point out is, with respect to this, in contrast to a lot of other cases where reversible error is found, this was an isolated comment. This was not revisited again. As Mr. Petty pointed out correctly, the prosecutor was just in the beginning of her argument, giving a quick overview of what the proof was, and then said the comment that brings us here. And then the rest of her argument is dedicated to the proof that was shown of the events. She never repeated this comment again. So I think those circumstances weigh in favor of finding not a reversible error on this comment alone. But since there's a second comment, there could be a cumulative error argument because that comment was also inappropriate. But this comment is also subject to some mitigation because the verdicts. There's also a suggestion that it was invited, and we can talk about that a little bit. But the other thing I think is important here is that once the objection was made, Judge Elliott, sensing the problem, intervened and gave an instruction to the jury. Then,
which raises an interesting question about whether the prosecutor's subsequent comment mitigated the instruction.
Well, the comment was before.
I thought she came back and later said after that, though, in further explanation.
After the judge gives
a limiting instruction, Ms. Valoria then goes on to say, well, my statement wasn't directed at the defendant,
right.
It was directed at the lawyer, which
You give some, you get some, I guess, so to speak.
You're right.
Troubled by the attempt to rehabilitate oneself.
That's right.
And then I'm bothered, why didn't Judge Elliott step in and say, well, that's contrary to my limiting instruction, but maybe there was some deal reached at the bench. I don't know
what people could
say about this. I have no idea.
I'm going to assume that's not the case. What we do know is that there's a motion for a mistrial at the close of the trial. and the judge made his findings about whether or not he thought it was sufficiently improper to warrant a mistrial, and he said no. But yeah, the instruction...
Did he address that subsequent comment specifically in the mistrial motion?
I don't think he addressed it specifically. I think he looked at it more in the context of what occurred as a result of what the prosecutor thought was an invited response, the instruction, and then subsequent events, but not specifically, no. So I would suggest to the court that even though the comments were improper on their face, reversal would not be warranted because the defendant's right to a fair trial was not violated. There's also a question about whether or not there's overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case to further mitigate the possibility of a fair trial being denied.
What do you do with Mr. Petty's argument that ties the prosecutorial misconduct to the shakiness of the kidnapping count?
Well, naturally, I don't agree it's shaky. The facts of the case indicate that Mr. Gamwell burst in on the victim, restrained her for a moment or two, sat on her leg so she couldn't move, tied her up, moved her from one section of the house into another, started in the bedroom, moved into the kitchen, then later into the living room. Subsequently, Mr. Gamwell indicated his overarching plan was what the victim referred to as a mountain funeral or a murder-suicide. The plan was he's in trouble with the police. He has melanoma. He's dying. He is on the run from the police department, and he's already told his family goodbye. So just from the standpoint of the kidnapping charge in the abstract.
It's kidnapping in first degree, though.
Right. Kidnapping in the first degree, as a matter of definition, is for the purpose of murder or killing someone or causing substantial
harm. And Mr. Hattelstadt, that is what I guess at this point, looking at this argument about overwhelming evidence, if we get rid of the weapons enhancement, the jury got rid of that, got rid of the attempt murder. So now we're left with this undefined area of substantial bodily harm.
I disagree.
And that's why I'm asking you the question.
Here's why. This is how I view the case, and if you disagree, we can discuss it. But as I see it, there was never an act conducted by Mr. Gamwell beyond mere preparation to murder her. What we know is she had been restrained, moved, and seized for the purpose of killing her, the murder-suicide. That's kidnapping in the first degree. Now, what the acquittal means is that the jury did not find that he had taken an act beyond mere preparation in furtherance of killing the victim. And the reason they reached that conclusion, I think, is because they could not find the rope, they could not find ligature marks, and so the testimony of the victim that she was being strangled was not supported by the evidence. And the only evidence that might tend to support that, aside from the victim, was one of the intervening neighbors who heard the hue and cry and came forward and saw Mr. Gamwell hunched over the victim. But from his angle, he couldn't see what he was doing. So we have a claim that a rope was used. We have no ligature marks, and we have no rope. So the jury was certainly well within its right to acquit on that for lack of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But that doesn't save the argument that there should have been a judgment of acquittal.
But does it not implicate that there was harm?
No.
From the prosecutor's statement that if this defendant weren't afraid of the truth, he would have testified. And I'm mischaracterizing her statement. I'm taking it too far. But that's his argument, that the prosecutor's comment on the defendant's failure to testify, in effect, harmed his chances of an acquittal on the kidnapping first-degree charge.
Well, to an extent. But, you know, and I don't really like the invited error argument a lot, because it seems to muddy the surface a bit. But when you have defense lawyers saying, there's another story out there that you haven't heard about, and they have lawyers saying, our client is innocent, you're an innocent guy, we're advising you don't testify in this case, don't do it. I think I see your point, but again, looking just at it from the standpoint of misconduct, that mitigates the error. But I don't think it affects the sufficiency of the evidence. You know, on review, you look at it in the light most favorable to the state.
And your point would be that defense counsel went further considerably than the jury instruction by actually representing to the jury as fact that they counseled him not to take the stand?
Yeah, that's a fact, not an evidence. You can't do that. Prosecutor can do that. No lawyer can do that. It's not the most egregious act of misconduct because we have the jury instruction, which implies that the defendant acted on advice. But when the lawyer stands up and says, as an innocent man, don't do it, and then says, you know, there's another story out there you haven't heard. You know, again, not to say that everything was okie-dokie here, but it mitigates the impact of the alleged misconduct, I think is the point. And that's separate and apart from the sufficiency of evidence claim that Justice Douglas and I were talking about.
Mr. Petty's argument caught me a little bit by surprise concerning the failure to instruct on the definition of substantial bodily harm, because I didn't see that argument in the fast track statement.
I'm pretty sure it was there.
Well, I don't. My understanding is the argument about kidnapping is focused on the duality of convictions as opposed to whether or not there was an error in instructions.
Well, I don't want to make up an argument for Mr. Petty.
Yeah, but assuming for the moment that it is,
I think it's in section 3 where he talks about the acquittal.
Well, let's assume for the moment that it's raised. Is substantial bodily harm something that is part of the jury instructions? And if that's an error in the instructions, is that a ground for reversal, independent of these misconduct discussions?
Okay. Well, we'll try and break that down. The jury was not instructed on substantial bodily harm. That in itself is not a reversible error, because the evidence of the purpose for the kidnapping was shown by overwhelming evidence. So that error, even if it's a structural error, would not create or would not put us in a position where there would be a reasonable doubt about the sufficiency of the evidence or the validity of the conviction. That's how I view that. Because I don't think this case was decided on substantial bodily harm, because no one said there was any. She was beat up. So I think even if the instruction had been given, there's unlikely to be a finding on that. But the overwhelming evidence in the case was this was a movement, a seizure, and a restraint for the purpose of murder. And the jury's verdict on that, as I said before, was not anything more than an act in mere preparation of the attempted murder itself. But that doesn't take it outside the realm of first-degree kidnapping. You know, insofar as we have those events that take it, you know, exceeding the need for the restraint, whether or not domestic battery and so forth has movement as an inherent element of it and so forth and so on. And the jury in the case was given the comprehensive instruction on Mendoza. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's a real issue with that. But as this dovetails back to the misconduct, again, I think, you know, as the case has said many times, you need to look at the entire case in a context, and that's all part of the context. So when you have a jury not convicting on all counts, even though they've been told he's guilty, they readily discern the key elements of fact and the evidence from the witnesses, make a determined verdict in terms of, you know, not proof beyond a reasonable doubt of weapons and attempted murder, and actually find what the defendant did do, which was the battery, in addition to the burglary and the kidnapping. That seems to be indicative of fair trial and not error requiring a reversal.
Well, the argument seems to be on page 16, lines 12 through 16, where he says, in this instance, the restraint used against Ms. Blansett did not substantially increase the risk of harm over and above that necessarily present in an associated offense, i.e. battery resulting in substantial bodily harm, in effect because it appears the injuries suffered occurred outside the house after she had run from the front yard.
Well, I disagree with that. Clearly, she was jumped inside the house, but at that, I'm confident that is not the basis for the battery. That's what happened outside. But when you look at what happened inside of the house, she is restrained. And the movement associated with the crimes for battery would be not inherent in this crime. There essentially is no movement inherent in battery. There, unless you knock somebody in the face and they fall over, that would be movement. But that wouldn't be a kidnap, because that movement is incidental to the battery. Likewise, if you take somebody by the lapels and punch them in the nose, that's restraint. But that's inherent in the crime of that battery. Here we have the woman is jumped, she is held by the legs, she's tied and duct taped for the purpose of taking her in her car, driving her into the desert, and killing her. Now, she cannot yell for help, she cannot get away, and she's being restrained. All those add up to an increase in the substantial increase in the risk of harm. The other point that's consistent with Mendoza is the restraint had an independent purpose. And the purpose was to restrain her so that she can be facilitated out of the house and then murdered. So there's all these factors that would be taken into consideration here, not the least of which is the movement. There is no movement inherent in a battery. And yet we have an independent purpose here for this seizure, restraint, and movement. And then we have a significant increase in the risk of harm because essentially she's got to get away, which she ultimately does. The neighbors hear the hue and cry and come running. But I think all of these factors taken together satisfy Mendoza and frankly, probably a lot of the other cases that came before it. So I think in terms of the sufficiency of the evidence on the dual conviction theory of, you know, insufficient evidence, I think we meet that, especially if you view the evidence in the light most favorable to the state.
Okay.
Do you attach any significance to the fact that she was evidently asthmatic and the duct tape?
That was argued. The prosecutor argued that because she was asthmatic, that the duct tape became a deadly weapon. The jury didn't agree. But in a sense, it would increase the risk of harm to the victim by virtue of her asthmatic state.
Yeah, that was my point on whether that is additional evidence on that point as well. But that was not the point of the prosecutor's argument.
I think it was a point, but I don't think it was the major point. And I discount it simply by virtue of the verdict because of the deadly weapon enhancement. But I suppose to an extent, you know, it did increase the risk of harm, but I wouldn't say significantly because he took it off from time to time. So I don't think I can claim that with a straight face.
Okay, any other questions from my colleagues? All right, Mr. Adelseth,
thank you very much.
Mr. Petty, you may proceed with your response. You had limited time. I'll give you 2 minutes.
I will be very quick. Just 2 points. The first is, I just want to make sure that the record reflects that what counsel told the jury was, and this is volume 8, at page 109 to 110, quote, "And under the advice of me and Mr. Slocum, we told Mr. Gamwell, don't do it," unquote, which means don't testify. It wasn't that you're an innocent person, don't testify. They just told the jury, we told him, don't do it. On the question of kidnapping, I respectfully disagree with Mr. Hattelstedt. I don't think the evidence was overwhelming on kidnapping, even on the movement score. As set forth under this court's clarification in Mendoza, two movements inside the house after he had tied her up in the bedroom. She asked to go into the living room. At her request, they moved to the living room at her request through the kitchen. And from the kitchen, she led the way into the living room and sat down on the couch where she wanted to sit. So it's not like he was dragging her or pulling her or what have you. Second movement is after she's bolted out the door, and he is chased after her, and he grabs her. They crash through a fence. The movement there is pulling her back into the yard while he's beating her. So it is incidental to the beating itself. So under Mendoza, I don't believe that the evidence is sufficient to sustain the kidnapping count, and we would ask that it be reversed by this court.
Could you comment on my confusion, or at least help me with it? I understood your argument to be a jury instruction error argument, and I do not see that in the fast-track statement. Am I wrong?
Justice Hardesty. If you look at the appeal, it's an appeal from the judgment of conviction and from an order denying a motion for directed verdict or judgment notwithstanding the verdict, I believe. And maybe in my fast-track statement I didn't capture the argument as well as it was stated in the motion to the district court judge. But that's the predicate for the argument. And then I'll simply share with you this. As I was speaking with my colleague Cheryl Bond yesterday, I asked her, have you ever, in preparing for oral argument, written a better argument than you wrote when you filed the brief? And she said yes. And so I think that maybe that's what we have here.
So you'd like us to substitute the oral argument on this issue for the fast track statement.
Or to be totally fair to Mr. Hattelstedt, if you want supplemental briefing on that point, I'll be happy to do that. But yeah, in essence, if you don't want supplemental briefing, I'd love you to consider the notion, the argument, that the jury just wasn't instructed on substantial bodily harm, as it is specifically defined in Nevada, and therefore the kidnapping count.
You'd agree that the fast track doesn't articulate.
It doesn't set it forth in that. It does raise that from that motion, but it doesn't present it as crystal clear as I did this morning.
On page 17, you do say, but since the jury was not instructed on the definition of substantial bodily harm, it cannot be said that the jury unanimously rested its decision on that basis.
Right. So. I think in writing, working on this for the last couple of days, my argument became better. Unfortunately, I have a time frame to file my brief, so
I'm not being critical. I just want to.
Oh, I understand. I appreciate the question.
Thank you very much for your arguments, counsel, and your statements here. We appreciate your assistance. The matter will stand submitted.
Thank you.